You will never get a great executive team to feel responsible for something that they had no role in making.
Welcome to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany, where business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers. Each episode, we have three items on the agenda: pressure, lessons, and boardroom dynamics. I'm Emily Sheffield, journalist, broadcaster, former newspaper editor, and board member. And I'm looking forward to sitting down with senior leaders to talk about what really goes on behind boardroom doors when the pressure's on and the stakes are high. Joining me this week is Margaret Heffernan. Margaret is an entrepreneur, author, and one of the most influential business thinkers of our time. She has an incredible amount of experience in the boardroom, having been CEO of five companies and running internet businesses during the dot-com boom. Margaret spent years at the BBC producing award-winning documentaries before moving into the business world. She is now Professor of Practice at the University Bath School of Management and lead faculty for the Forward Institute's Responsible Leadership Programme. She mentors CEOs and senior executives of major global organisations. Her TED Talks, including the famous Dare to Disagree, have been watched by many millions of people worldwide. And she's a best-selling author. Among a number of titles, the groundbreaking Willful Blindness examines why we ignore obvious dangers. Welcome to the podcast, Margaret.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Emily.
Let's start with agenda item number one, boardroom pressure. Can you take us back to a time when you felt the most pressure in a boardroom?
Well, you know, it's a kind of hard choice. Because certainly in the very early days of the internet, when, you know, nobody really quite knew what it was or could be, or nobody knew what it would become, really. There was a lot of pressure, partly to build software that worked. That was a kind of fundamental requirement. On some level, that was the easiest part. The second pressure was to find an audience for that, because obviously there wasn't a pre-existing audience. So everything was a bit of a stab in the dark. And then to find a way to position what had been built in the pious hope that the business would grow and have some kind of proof point, some validation that we had landed up in some patch of the market where there was capacity for growth, where there was an audience that was eager to start exploring what this new technology could be, and adventurous in its taste. But obviously not too adventurous, because then it would make it a niche business and everybody was really very, very focused at the time on mass businesses. That kind of pendulum tended to swing back and forth quite a bit. But yes, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, I have to say also in the very early days, there was not enormous pressure to deliver tremendous returns. So that's unusual. It doesn't, in my experience, take the pressure off. On some level, you know, if you're making tons of money, there are a lot of questions boards don't ask. When you don't know if you could ever make any money, the questions are different, more ambiguous, more complex, and it's very hard to know who's right.
As you've just explained, you know, this was a very sort of volatile business era. I mean, the internet was very new. These businesses were very exciting. They were having a lot of money pumped into them. As you say, there was a huge amount of ambiguity about what the goals were, really, other than grow, grow, grow. How did you, in the boardroom, how did you sort of cope with that ambiguity? Because in a way, that's quite a pressure in itself. How were you sort of feeling your way? And I guess, looking back, what, you know, were there things you did right, things that you did wrong? What were you learning at the time?
There were things I did right. There were things I did wrong. I was definitely learning all the time. I think it helped that everybody was. I think in that very early stage, the industry attracted people who were pretty comfortable with uncertainty. They were very interested, as I was, in what was this new thing and what could it become. And nobody could tell you, well, this is how it's done, because nobody knew. the phrase we always used to use was, you know, there are no footprints in the sand. You can't turn back and see, oh, this is how you get to the pot of gold. So that was intellectually incredibly challenging because kind of almost everything might be true. It was also creatively very exciting. And I would also say that at that very first stage where there was a great deal of naivety, there's also a great deal of absolutely top-notch, brilliant innovation. People who weren't trying to copy, who weren't trying to kind of do a only slightly modified version, you know, this sort of thing that you see in traditional businesses, whereas, you know, we're going to make the same sort of biscuit, but we're going to make it yellow, or we're going to make it vegan, or, you know, these tiny incremental things really held no appeal whatsoever. So if you were bold, it was a fantastic environment in which to work. And I was really lucky to hire some extraordinary talents who were either new to the internet or indeed, in the case of my chief technology officer, had been the recipient of the first email ever sent, you know, so had pretty much helped build the internet. So that made it very exciting. It meant that you got a very particular kind of person who wanted to come and work in that business. I would say that I had a board that was pretty supportive and open-minded. But, you know, you had to be on top of your game. You had to have a strategy. You had to be able to articulate it. You had to be able to articulate the assumptions on which it was built, and be able to identify, well, you know, what are you doing that will give us some indication as to whether you're going in the right direction or not. So, you know, again, a lot of pressure on creativity, articulation, communication. Could you talk to the market about it in a way that the market might conceivably understand? That was an enormous pressure.
And you had your board told you in the late 90s, which was just before the sort of dot-com market correction, your board told you the business needed repositioning, that the product was too bland. A, could you explain what the product was so our listeners understand that? And then how did you feel as a CEO to hear that, and how did you react?
Well, I think this was actually a really good example of a board working very well, to be honest. I think they were right. It was too bland. You know, one of the problems about searching for big numbers is you're trying to appeal to everybody, which means you will be pretty bland. There's just no other way to do it. And so when they asked me, you know, how are you going to reposition this? It was a really deeply clarifying question. And I remember one of our board members was Avram Miller, who at the time was head of business development at Intel. You know, had seen the beginning of the internet very, very early, had a brilliant mind about it. And so that was my investors' board. So they brought a lot of really great questions. And then my own company's board came from more traditional industries, but came from businesses that had themselves repositioned quite often. So I felt in that context, I had quite a lot of great thinking on my side and some tremendous allies. And we did reposition the company. We decided to focus it on a market that we called trailblazers. So these were people who were more afraid of missing out than messing up. They were classic early adopters. They loved things like adventure sports, very exotic new cuisines, adventure travel, very cutting-edge stuff. It was very appropriate to the people who were spending lots of time on the internet in that period. It was also, and this turned out, I mean, I'd love to say it was, you know, my personal genius. I think it was some collective genius combined with good luck. It turned out to be a fantastically lucrative audience.
You assembled quite an unusual team to solve the problem, which included a young web developer, that makes sense, but also a media executive and an artist. That's not a typical corporate team structure. How did you first explain that to the board, their thinking? I mean, were there raised eyebrows? How did you communicate that to them?
Well, you know, there wasn't any conventional thinking at the time because nobody really knew how to do what we were doing. I mean, I think it's also fair to say that I had a board that you know, did not particularly get involved in, you know, exactly what is Margaret doing today. We agreed that the repositioning was necessary, and I just cracked on and did it. And we then delivered it in 90 days, and it turned out to be a phenomenal success.
I'm sure it was a really, really exciting time. And I'm sure your board, I assume, reacted extremely positively after 90 days. But Margaret, it also sounds like the board itself had been well assembled, because they had spotted the problem.
Yep.
But they hadn't told you how to fix it. They just said, this is the problem. Now you go and find a solution. And it appears they seem to have given you quite a lot of freedom to do that. So the makeup of the board itself, were these quite open-minded people? They were as adventurous as you were. You know, they were excited by what they could see, because you don't always get boards like this. This sounds like a good board. Like,
no, you definitely don't always get boards like that. I think, I think it was a very exceptional time for a start. I think also that it was a very rich mix of people from old media and new media, who were both keen to learn from each other. I think the board had quite a lot of humility, in the sense that we all thought we were brave, imaginative, and brilliant, but we also were deeply cognizant of our own ignorance and the uncertainty of the entire market and new technology. I think it's fair to say that both my investor and my board, neither had great interest in telling me what to do. They had great focus on making sure that the strategy was right. And I think that's absolutely right about boards. I mean, I now chair boards. I've sat on many, many boards. And the only time I would ever get in the weeds of an operating business is if I think it's absolutely close to collapse. And I have done that on occasion and pulled out the minute I felt it was safe to do so, because I believe very firmly that the board does not know as much about the operations of a business as the staff working there do. And unless the staff are all universally incompetent, which, you know, does sometimes happen, but unless that's the case, you want the people who really know how the business works to be building it and feel responsible for it. You will never get a great executive team to feel responsible for something that they had no role in making.
Listen, let's move to agenda item number two, boardroom lessons. You know, very simple, open question, but what's the biggest board lesson that you've learned?
I would say don't try to game the board ever. Be really honest. Don't pretend to achievements you haven't got. Don't pretend to optimism that you can't back up. I mean, the biggest fight I ever had with my board was the last internet company that I ran, which I was asked to take over when the CEO was fired. And it was midway through developing some very, very interesting multimedia technology. We finished building that very successfully. We did a lot of proof of concept online events, which showed that we could do what we were set up in business to do. And then I went to the board and I said, you know, I've done everything that needed doing at this stage of the business. What I can't figure out with this business is how it is ever, ever, ever going to be profitable. And I have, you know, I've thought of it every which way I can. I've done that with my team. We were very good at this. I can't figure it out, because at the moment, it's in the nature of the beast that it costs a huge amount to run. And the more customers we get, the more expensive it becomes, which is exactly what you do not want in any business. So my advice to you is fire me or shut it down, because I can't figure it out. It's the biggest fight I ever had with them. The chairman of the board, you know, really was in love with the business. He thought I could walk on water. I kept saying, no, I can't walk on water. I then went and tried very hard to sell it to every, apparently a strategically appropriate business that I could find. and I couldn't do that. And finally, the board agreed with me and said, Margaret's right, we should shut this down. Now, that also turned out to be a very clever thing to do, but that was luck. It wasn't anybody's judgment. We shut it down before the tech bust. So that was smart, but it's not that anybody could see the tech bust coming. What it did do is it left everybody's reputations intact because we didn't have to shut it down in a frenzy. All the employees could stay in the offices while they went for their new jobs. What we had done in the business was technologically so difficult that they all got fantastic new jobs off the back of it. We paid off all of our debts. We closed down partnerships that we put together with a lot of elegance and respect, and everybody left with their heads held high. 6 months later, companies were just, you know, shutting the doors, running away, and leaving their bills unpaid. So, part of what that showed me is that even when you have to take a very hard decision like that, you should, the only question you should ask is what's best for the business, not what's best for me. What's best for the business? That's the CEO job, in my job, in my view. And even when you have to take, you know, a very disappointing decision like that, you still have a choice, which is you can do it really well or you can do it really badly.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Very good advice. Very good observations. Finally, agenda item number three, and we're probably going to spend a bit of time on here because it's boardroom dynamics, and I think you've got a lot to say about boardroom dynamics. I actually wanted to start with a question about being a woman, because you on a board and as a CEO, because we are talking about the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been lots of improvements. So I guess I want to look at your experiences back then, but I think it'd be nice to bring it forward, mm-hmm. You know.
Sure.
How do you think the dynamics have changed? Maybe a good way to approach this for women in boards and how we work and how we approach work. And do you think those dynamics have got better for women and diversity, I might add?
I think the dynamics have improved a bit, not nearly as much as I would have hoped. I would say when I was running my internet companies, I was the only female CEO for most of the time that I was doing that. I think one other CEO joined my last year, maybe. In some ways, that's kind of an interesting and almost privileged position. I think there was a slightly old-fashioned feeling around the table that it was kind of unchivalrous to beat up on women. So I didn't get beaten up on the way that the guys definitely did. I think that my collaborative style of management was sometimes regarded as weakness. So when I asked my CTO to do a presentation instead of doing it myself, I was later told that that was not appropriate, even though he was going to be much better than I was. You know, it had to be me. Fair enough. I disagreed. But anyway, that I was as collaborative as I was, I think, struck them as weakness, which is, you know, a common thing that happens to women.
Yeah, I've experienced that.
Yeah. I did at one point discover that in the portfolio, which held my business and other businesses, the male CEOs were paid twice what I was paid. And when I drew that to the attention of the board, it was immediately doubled. But that was a very uncomfortable moment. There were certainly times, you know, we would have these corporate retreats, which were pretty kind of normal things boards have. I would be the only woman there. And, you know, it was a pretty kind of rough and tumble time. And so I remember one retreat where the big game was, let's all jump into our hire cars after drinking a lot and race around the car park. Which at the moment I decided to go to bed and read a book. So there was certainly the well-observed thing that women are often left out of where the kind of informal information exchanges take place. I have to say, it didn't bother me. I stayed very, very focused on what I was doing. And the rest was kind of water off a duck's back, if I'm being honest. But did I like it? No. Did I approve of it? No. I just kept very focused on doing my job. I thought, I'm here to deliver results. And as long as I deliver results, I'm okay. And when I stop delivering results, then there's going to be trouble. I mentor chief executives and have done for about the last 15 years. And there are certainly a handful whom I know to have been underpaid compared to their male predecessors. And the board has known that and done nothing about it. And I have been familiar with at least one board that certainly has tolerated a serial sexual harasser. I say all of this with immense grief because it's caused harm to my mentees, because it makes me feel very discouraged for young women who are bringing tremendous intelligence, energy, and commitments to companies that still struggle to take them seriously. And we're at a time, you know, in the world where we can't afford to lose talent and commitment, where we need all the brains we can assemble to try and figure out, you know, what on earth we're doing in this crazy world.
You've written that 85% of executives have issues they won't raise at work because they're afraid of conflict. Why are people so afraid? I mean, my feeling is that it's not that people might be afraid of conflict. It's if you're bringing out something tricky, I wonder if we lack the tools to both give that information, that hard information, and for executives to receive it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right. And this is why I became a professor at the University of Bath, because that was exactly what I wanted to teach. And it is what I teach. It's twofold. It's partly that people are afraid of conflict because they have very little experience of it. Very few people have what I would regard as professionally competent skills at negotiation. They're afraid to start an argument that they feel they can't really manage, that it might go out of control. And they're afraid that they will be punished for being troublemakers. So if you look at the academic literature, which is where the 85% number comes from, the reasons given why people stay silent is either that they're afraid of being misunderstood or they're afraid of being punished. So it seems like a big risk to take without any confidence of reward. So what I do at the university and also with executive groups is I teach them how to dealing. So I teach them using true case studies how to discern a way through. Because I don't think you should start a fight if you don't have some kind of notion of how you might win it. Right, to start a fight without any plan is foolish. And that's often why people stay silent, because they can't think of a plan. They think frequently, well, either I stand on the tabletop and scream about this, or I just say nothing, and saying nothing is just easier. So that's what they revert to. So I think we need a lot more training in it. I think we need a great deal more training in listening. Really, really listening to what people are saying or what they're trying to say. I did this sort of personal experiment on myself, if you like, with one group that I work with. I meet them every month. And I felt after a while that I just wasn't being taken very seriously. I wasn't building very good relationships. And I'm not sure now whether I was just being thoughtful or I was sulking, but I decided, right, well, from now on at these meetings, I'm just not going to say anything. And it turned out to be one of the most brilliant things I've ever done professionally, because once you know you're not going to say anything, boy, do you listen differently. Because actually it struck me that most of the time people are listening, they're not listening. They're sitting there waiting for the moment in which they can jump in to make their point. Well, you know, the brain won't multitask. You can't both think about what you want to say and think about what the person talking is saying. So mostly you're missing what's been said, which may explain a lot about meetings. I knew I wasn't going to speak, I could really, really listen. I could listen and hear who were the voices that were being ignored, who was not speaking. I could start asking myself questions like, how much more information do we need? Is that the problem? How much of this decision do we have to take today? All decisions involve trade-offs. So if we go down the road that everybody seems to be recommending, who gets hurt? Somebody's going to get hurt. Who is it going to be? Have we talked about that? Are there questions that we should be asking that we're not asking? And it was a fantastic experience. And it's something, I mean, it's become a kind of default position now, because it strikes me that in a meeting, somebody's got to listen. And very few people do, and very few people know how to. And I love it. I do a lot of professional speaking for my life. I love having an opportunity to shut up and listen. I learn a lot.
Can you give a sort of concrete example of where you've had, you know, not even constructive conflict, where a board has actually spilled into very unconstructive conflict? How do you work through that?
Well, it's funny. I wrote about this recently. I sat on the board of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art for quite a long time. And after, I think, my second meeting, I had this really, really strong feeling that something was badly wrong and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I reached out to the board member who had recruited me, and he convened a very small meeting, a subset of the board. And we all agreed that actually we all felt the same way, but we didn't know what the problem was. It just felt like the board meetings were stage managed. They were just too smooth. Anyway, we brought a lot more scrutiny to the board. We started asking a lot harder questions. As we did, the executive became very, very much more defensive. And at one point, we had a board away day, and we were going through some of the finances. And it was a very difficult board because it's required by statute to have half other people and half people in the dramatic arts. And so you had this very difficult cultural misunderstanding where the artists thought they didn't understand how to run organizations and had nothing to say. And the business people thought didn't want to frighten or intimidate the actors and theater people. So everybody tiptoed around each other. It was terrible. It was a really terrible board. Anyway, we have this away day and we're going kind of tiptoeing through the finances. And suddenly this very famous, very brilliant actor, Sylvia Sims, famous playing the Queen Mother in The Crown, in her most royal tones said, "Excuse me, but are you saying that the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art is going bust?" And it was just a magic moment because she'd called it. God bless her. She had more courage than anybody else in that room. Because the answer was, yeah, we are in deep, 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 deep trouble. And the executive is pretending that we're not. And the board is trying to do something, but is being too tentative. And if we go on like this, we will go bust. And from that moment forward, everybody rolled up their sleeves and said, right, okay, well, we can't let this happen. So we need to change a whole bunch of stuff. And it was the one occasion where we did get pretty much in the weeds of operating the business. As soon as we were safely out of our financial peril, things went back to normal. And I think we managed that kind of interregnum with a fair amount of, decency. We were very alert to the fact that as board members, we did want to exit as fast as we could. But it was really difficult. And there was a very, very real possibility that the Academy would have been unable to be the independent and fantastic institution that it is today.
I've so enjoyed your insights, and I'm sure our audience have, but we always finish with one final question. If you could go back to your first board meeting, what would you tell yourself?
Don't be afraid. Listen really well. Figure out what are the areas of the business to which you bring the greatest expertise, and start there.
Margaret Heffernan, thank you so much for sharing your boardroom stories with us and giving us your time and commitment. I've personally learned so much from you today, and I'm definitely going to be rushing out and buying some of your books. You've been listening to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany. Sherpany is a leading meeting management solution designed to meet the unique needs of the board, board committee, and executive meetings. Find out more at sherpany.com. And make sure you subscribe to the Boardroom Confidential podcast to hear more business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers.